Wolf Hall, Disc 8.
Twilight finds the king melancholy. Another day of regress in his campaign to be a married man again. He denies, of course, that he is married to the queen. Cromwell, he says, I need to find my way to ownership of those... He looks sidelong, not wishing to say what he means. I understand there are legal difficulties. I do not pretend to understand them, and before you begin, I do not want them explained. The Cardinal has endowed his Oxford College, as also the school at Ipswich, with land that will produce an income in perpetuity. Henry wants their silver and gold plate, their libraries, their yearly revenues, and the land that produces the revenues, and he does not see why he should not have what he wants. The wealth of 29 monasteries has gone into those foundations, suppressed by permission of the Pope, on condition that the proceeds were used for the colleges. But do you know, Henry says, I am beginning to care very little about the Pope and his permissions. It is early summer. The evenings are long and the grass, the air, scented. You would think that a man like Henry, on a night like this, could go to whichever bed he pleases. The court is full of eager women, but after this interview, he will walk in the garden with Lady Anne, her hand resting on his arm, deep in conversation. Then he will go to his empty bed, and she, one presumes, to hers. When the king asks him what he hears from the cardinal, he says that he misses the light of His Majesty's countenance, that preparations for his enthronement at York are in hand. Then why doesn't he get to York? It seems to me he delays and delays. Henry glares at him. I will say this for you. You stick by your man. I have never had anything from the cardinal other than kindness. Why would I not? And you have no other master, the king says. My Lord Suffolk asks me, where does the fellow spring from? I tell him there are Cromwells in Leicestershire, Northamptonshire, landed people, or once they were. I suppose you're from some unfortunate branch of that family. No. You may not know your own forebears. I shall ask the heralds to look into it. Your Majesty is kind, but they will have scant success. The king is exasperated. He is failing to take advantage of what is on offer, a pedigree, however meagre. My Lord Cardinal told me you were an orphan. He told me you were brought up in a monastery. Ah, that was one of his little stories. He told me little stories? Several expressions chase each other across the king's face. Annoyance, amusement, a wish to call back times past. I suppose he did. He told me that you had a loathing of those in the religious life. That was why he found you diligent in his work. That was not the reason. He looks up. May I speak? Oh, for God's sake, Henry cries. I wish someone would. He is startled. Then he understands. Henry wants a conversation on any topic. One that's nothing to do with love or hunting or war. Now that Wolsey's gone, there's not much scope for it. Unless you want to talk to a priest of some stripe. And if you send for a priest, what does it come back to? To love, to Anne, to what you want and can't have. If you ask me about the monks, I speak from experience, not prejudice, and though I have no doubt that some foundations are well governed, my experience has been of waste and corruption. May I suggest to your Majesty that if you wish to see a parade of the seven deadly sins, you do not organise a masque at court, but call without notice at a monastery. I have seen monks who live like great lords, on the offerings of poor people, who would rather buy a blessing than buy bread. And that is not Christian conduct. Nor do I take the monasteries to be the repositories of learning some believe they are. Was Grocyn a monk? Or Colet? Or Lineker? Or any of the great scholars? They were university men. The monks take in children and use them as servants. They don't even teach them dog Latin. I don't grudge them some bodily comforts. It cannot always be lent. What I cannot stomach is hypocrisy, fraud, idleness. Their worn-out relics, their threadbare worship, and their lack of invention. When did anything good last come from a monastery? They do not invent. They only repeat. And what they repeat is corrupt. For hundreds of years the monks have held the pen, and what they have written is what we take to be our history. But I do not believe it really is. I believe they have suppressed the history they don't like and written one that is favourable to Rome. Henry appears to look straight through him to the wall behind. He waits. Henry says, "Dog holes, then?" He smiles. Henry says, "Our history, as you know, I am gathering evidence. Manuscripts, opinions, comparisons with how matters are ordered in other countries. Perhaps you would consult with those learned gentlemen. Put a little direction into their efforts. Talk to Dr. Cranmer. He will tell you what is needed. I could make good use of the money that flows yearly to Rome. King Francois is richer by far than I am. I do not have a tenth of his subjects. He taxes them as he pleases. For my part, I must call Parliament. If I do not, there are riots," he adds bitterly. "And riots if I do." "Take no lessons from King Francois," he says. "He likes war too much and trade too little." Henry smiles faintly. "You do not think so, but to me that is the remit of a king. There is more tax to be raised when trade is good. And if taxes are resisted, there may be other ways." Henry nods. "Very well. Begin with the colleges. Sit down with my lawyers." Harry Norris is there to show him out of the king's private rooms. Not smiling for once, rather stern, he says, "I wouldn't be his tax collector." He thinks, "Are the most remarkable moments of my life to be spent under the scrutiny of Henry Norris? He killed his father's best men, Empsom, Dudley. Didn't the Cardinal get one of their houses?" A spider scuttles from under a stool and presents him with a fact. "Empsom's house on Fleet Street, granted the 9th of October, the first year of this reign. This glorious reign," Norris says, as if he were issuing a correction. Gregory is 15 as summer begins. He sits a horse beautifully, and there are good reports of his swordsmanship. His Greek, well, his Greek is where it was. But he has a problem. "People in Cambridge are laughing at my greyhounds." "Why?" The black dogs are a matched pair. They have curving muscled necks and dainty feet. They keep their eyes lowered, mild and demure, till they sight prey. "They say, why would you have dogs that people can't see at night? Only felons have dogs like that. They say I hunt in the forests against the law. They say I hunt badgers like a churl." "What do you want?" he asks. "White ones or some spots of colour?" "Either would be correct." "I'll take your black dogs." Not that he has time to go out, but Richard or Rafe will use them. "But what if people laugh?" "Really, Gregory," Joanne says, "this is your father. I assure you, no one will dare laugh." When the weather is too wet to hunt, Gregory sits poring over the golden legend. He likes the lives of the saints. "Some of these things are true," he says, "some not." He reads La Morte d'Arthur, and because it is the new edition, they crowd around him, looking over his shoulder at the title page. "Here beginneth the first book of the most noble and worthy prince, King Arthur, sometime King of Great Britain." In the forefront of the picture, two couples embrace. On a high-stepping horse is a man with a mad hat, made of coiled tubes like fat serpents. Alice says, "Sir, did you wear a hat like that when you were young?" And he says, "I had a different colour for each day in the week, but mine were bigger. Behind this man, a woman rides pillion. "Do you think this represents Lady Anne?" Gregory asks. "They say the king does not like to be parted from her, so he perches her up behind him like a farmer's wife." The woman has big eyes and looks sick from jolting. It might just be Anne. There is a small castle, not much taller than a man, with a plank for a drawbridge. The birds circling above look like flying daggers. Gregory says, "Our king takes his descent from this Arthur. He was never really dead, but waited in the forest biding his time, or possibly in a lake. He is several centuries old. Merlin is a wizard. He comes later. You will see. There are 21 chapters. If it keeps on raining, I mean to read them all. Some of these things are true, and some of them lies. But they are all good stories." When the king next calls him to court, he wants a message sent to Wolsey. A Breton merchant whose ship was seized by the English 8 years ago is complaining he has not had the compensation promised. No one can find the paperwork. It was the cardinal who handled the case. Will he remember it? "I'm sure he will," he says. "That will be the ship with powdered pearls for ballast, the hold packed with unicorn's horns." "God forbid," says Charles Brandon. But the king laughs and says, "That will be the one. If the sums are in doubt, or indeed the whole case, may I look after it?" The king hesitates. "I'm not sure you have a locus standi in the matter." It is at this moment that Brandon, quite unexpectedly, gives him a testimonial. "Harry, let him. When this fellow has finished, the Breton will be paying you." Dukes revolve in their spheres. When they confer, it is not for pleasure in each other's society. They like to be surrounded by their own courts, by men who reflect them and are subservient to them. For pleasure, they are as likely to be found with a kennel man as another duke. So it is that he spends an amiable hour with Brandon, looking over the king's hounds. It is not yet the season for hunting the hart, so the running dogs are well fed in their kennels, their musical barking rising into the evening air, and the tracking dogs, silent as they are trained to be, rise on their hind legs and watch, dripping saliva, the progress of their suppers. The kennel children are carrying baskets of bread and bones, buckets of offal, and basins of pig's blood pottage. Charles Brandon inhales, appreciative, like a dowager in a rose garden. A huntsman calls forward a favourite bitch, white, patched with chestnut, Barbada, 4 years old. He straddles her and pulls back her head to show her eyes, clouded with a fine film. He will hate to kill her, but he doubts she will be much use this season. He, Cromwell, cups the bitch's jaw in his hand. "You can draw off the membrane with a curved needle. I've seen it done. You need a steady hand and to be quick. She doesn't like it, but then she won't like to be blind." He runs his hand over her ribs, feels the panicked throb of her little animal heart. "The needle must be very fine, and just this length." He shows them between finger and thumb. "Let me talk to your smith." Suffolk looks sideways at him. "You're a useful sort of man." They walk away. The duke says, "Look here. The problem is my wife." He waits. "I've always wanted Henry to have what he wants. I've always been loyal to him. Even when he was talking about cutting my head off because I'd married his sister. But now what am I to do? Catherine is the queen, surely. My wife was always a friend of hers. She's beginning to talk of, I don't know, I'd give my life for the queen, that sort of thing. And for Norfolk's niece to have precedence over my wife, who is queen of France, we can't live with it, you see?" He nods. "I see." "Besides," the duke says, "I hear Wyatt is due back from Calais."
"Yes, and?"
"I wonder if I ought to tell him. Tell Henry, I mean, poor devil."
"My lord, leave it alone." The duke lapses into what, in another man,
you would call silent thought.
Summer. The king is hunting. If he wants him, he has to chase him. And if he is sent for, he goes. Henry visits, on his summer progress, his friends in Wiltshire, in Sussex, in Kent, or stays at his own houses, or the ones he's taken from the cardinal. Sometimes, even now, the queen in her stout little person rides out with a bow when the king hunts within one of his great parks, or in some lord's park, where the deer are driven to the archers. Lady Anne rides too, on separate occasions, and enjoys the pursuit. But there is a season to leave the ladies at home and ride into the forest with the trackers and the running hounds, to rise before dawn when the light is clouded like a pearl, to consult with the huntsman and then unharbour the chosen stag. You do not know where the chase will end or when. Harry Norris says to him, laughing, "Your turn soon, Master Cromwell, if he continues to favour you as he does. A word of advice. As the day begins and you ride out, pick a ditch. Picture it in your mind. When he has worn out three good horses, when the horn is blowing for another chase, you will be dreaming of that ditch. You will imagine lying down in it. Dead leaves and cool ditch water will be all you desire." He looks at Norris, his charming self-deprecation. He thinks, "You were with my cardinal at Putney when he fell on his knees in the dirt. Did you offer the pictures in your head to the court, to the world, to the students of Gray's Inn? For if not you, then who?" In the forest you may find yourself lost without companions. You may come to a river which is not on a map. You may lose sight of your quarry and forget why you are there. You may meet a dwarf, or the living Christ, or an old enemy of yours, or a new enemy, one you do not know until you see his face appear between the rustling leaves and see the glint of his dagger. You may find a woman asleep in a bower of leaves. For a moment, before you don't recognize her, you will think she is someone you know. At Austin Friars, there is little chance to be alone, or alone with just one person. Every letter of the alphabet watches you. In the counting house there is young Thomas Avery, whom you are training up to take a grip on your private finances. Midway through the letters comes Marlinspike, strolling in the garden with his observant golden eyes. Towards the end of the alphabet comes Thomas Riothesley, pronounced Risley. He's a bright young man, 25 or so, and well-connected, son of York Herald, nephew to Garter King-at-Arms. In Wolsey's household he worked under your direction, then was carried away by Gardiner, as master secretary, to work for him. Now he is sometimes at court, sometimes at Austin Friars. He's Stephen Spy, the children say, Richard and Rafe. Master Risley is tall, with red-blonde hair, but without the propensity of others of that complexion, the king, let's say, to grow pink when gratified, or mottled when cross. He's always pale and cool, always his handsome self, always composed. At Trinity Hall, he was a great actor in the students' plays, and he has certain affectations, a consciousness of himself, of how he appears. They mimic him behind his back, Richard and Rafe, and say, "My name is Riothesley, but as I wish to spare you effort, you can call me Risley." They say he only complicates his name like that so he can come here and sign things and use up our ink. They say, you know Gardiner, he is too angry to use long names. Gardiner just calls him you. They are pleased with this joke, and for a while, every time Mr. W appears, they shout, "It's you!" "Have mercy," he says, "a Master Risley. Cambridge men should have our respect." He would like to ask them, Richard, Rafe, "Master Riothesley, call me Risley, do I look like a murderer? There is a boy who says I do."
This year there has been no summer plague. Londoners give thanks on their knees. On St. John's Eve, the bonfires burn all night. At dawn, white lilies are carried in from the fields. The city daughters, with shivering fingers, weave them into drooping wreaths to pin on the city's gates and on city doors. He thinks about that little girl like a white flower, the girl with Lady Anne, who manoeuvred herself around the door. It would have been easy to find out her name, except he didn't, because he was busy finding out secrets from Mary. Next time he sees her... But what's the use of thinking of it? She will come of some noble house. He had meant to write to Gregory and say, "I've seen such a sweet girl. I will find out who she is, and if I steer our family adroitly in the next few years, perhaps you can marry her." He has not written this. In his present precarious situation, it would be about as useful as the letters Gregory used to write to him. "Dear Father, I hope you are well. I hope your dog is well. And now, no more for lack of time." Lord Chancellor Moore says, "Come and see me, and we'll talk about Wolsey's colleges. I feel sure the King will do something for the poor scholars. Do come. Come and see my roses before the heat spoils them. Come and see my new carpet." It is a muted grey day. When he arrives at Chelsea, Master Secretary's barge is tied up, the Tudor flag limp in the sultry air. Beyond the gatehouse, the red brick house, new built, offers its bright facade to the river. He strolls towards it through the mulberry trees. Standing in the porch under the honeysuckle, Stephen Gardiner. The grounds at Chelsea are full of small pet animals, and as he approaches and his host greets him, he sees that the Chancellor of England is holding a lop-eared rabbit with snowy fur. It hangs peacefully in his hands, like ermine mittens. "Is your son-in-law Roper with us today?" Gardiner asks. "A pity. I hope to see him change his religion again. I wanted to witness it." "A garden tour," Moore offers. "I thought we might see him sit down a friend of Luther, as formerly he was, yet come back to the church by the time they bring in the currants and gooseberries." "Will Roper is now settled," Moore says, "in the faith of England and of Rome." He says, "It's not really a good year for soft fruit." Moore looks at him out of the tail of his eye. He smiles. He chats genially as he leads them into the house. Lolloping after them comes Henry Pattinson, a servant of Moore's, he sometimes calls his fool, and to whom he allows license. The man is a great brawler. Normally you take in a fool to protect him, but in Pattinson's case, it's the rest of the world needs protection. Is he really simple? There's something sly in Moore. He enjoys embarrassing people. It would be like him to have a fool that wasn't. Pattinson's supposed to have fallen from a church steeple and hit his head. At his waist, he wears a knotted string which he sometimes says is his rosary. Sometimes he says it is a scourge. Sometimes he says it is the rope that should have saved him from his fall. Entering the house, you meet the family hanging up. You see them painted life-size before you meet them in the flesh. And Moore, conscious of the double effect it makes, pauses to let you survey them, to take them in. The favourite, Meg, sits at her father's feet with a book on her knee. Gathered loosely about the Lord Chancellor are his son John, his ward, Anne Cressacre, who is John's wife, Margaret Giggs, who is also his ward, his aged father, Sir John Moore, his daughters Cicely and Elizabeth. Pattinson, with goggle eyes, and his wife, Alice, with lowered head and wearing a cross at the edge of the picture. Master Holbein has grouped them under his gaze and fixed them forever, as long as no moth consumes, no flame, or mould or blight. In real life, there is something fraying about their host, a suspicion of unravelling weave. Being at his leisure, he wears a simple wool gown. The new carpet, for their inspection, is stretched out on two trestle tables. The ground is not crimson, but a blush colour. Not rose madder, he thinks, but a red dye mixed with whey. "My Lord Cardinal liked Turkey carpets," he murmurs. "The Doge once sent him 60. The wool is soft wool from mountain sheep, but none of them were black sheep. Where the pattern is darkest, the surface has already a brittle feel from patchy dyeing, and with time and use it may flake away." He turns up the corner, runs his fingertips over the knots, counting them by the inch, in an easy, accustomed action. "This is the Giord's knot," he says, "but the pattern is from Pergamon. You see there, within the octagons, the eight-pointed star." He smooths down the corner and walks away from it, turns back and says, "There." He walks forward, puts a tender hand on the floor. The interruption in the weave, the lozenge slightly distorted, warped out of true. At worst, the carpet is two carpets pieced together. At best, it has been woven by the villagers Pattinson, or patched together last year by Venetian slaves in a backstreet workshop. To be sure, he needs to turn the whole thing over. His host says, "Not a goodbye." "It's beautiful," he says, not wanting to spoil his pleasure. But next time, he thinks, "take me with you." His hand skims the surface, rich and soft. The flaw in the weave hardly matters. A Turkey carpet is not on oath. There are some people in this world who like everything squared up and precise, and there are those who will allow some drift at the margins. He is both these kinds of person. He would not allow, for example, a careless ambiguity in a lease, but instinct tells him that sometimes a contract need not be drawn too tight. Leases, writs, statutes, all are written to be read, and each person reads them by the light of self-interest. Moore says, "What do you think, gentlemen? Walk on it, or hang it on the wall?" "Walk on it." "Thomas, your luxurious tastes." And they laugh. You would think they were friends. They go out to the aviary. They stand deep in talk, while finches flit and sing. A small grandchild toddles in. A woman in an apron shadows him or her. The child points to the finches, makes sounds expressive of pleasure, flaps its arms. It eyes Stephen Gardiner. Its small mouth turns down. The nurse swoops in before tears ensue. "How must it be," he asks Stephen, "to have such effortless power over the young?" Stephen scowls. Moore takes him by the arm. "Now, about the colleges," he says. "I have spoken to the king, and Master Secretary here has done his best. Truly he has. The king may refound Cardinal College in his name, but for Ipswich I see no hope. After all, it is only... I'm sorry to say this, Thomas, but it is only the birthplace of a man now disgraced, and so has no special claim on us." "It is a shame for the scholars." "It is, of course. Shall we go in to supper?" In Moore's great hall, the conversation is exclusively in Latin. Their Moore's wife, Alice, is their hostess and does not have a word of it. It is their custom to read a passage of scripture by way of a grace.
"It is Meg's turn tonight," Moore says.
He's keen to show off his darling. She takes the book, kissing it. Over the interruptions of the fool, she reads in Greek. Gardiner sits with his eyes shut tight. He looks not holy, but exasperated. He watches Margaret. She's perhaps 25. She has a sleek, darting head, like the head of the little fox, which Moore says he has tamed. All the same, he keeps it in a cage for safety. The servants come in. It is Alice's eye they catch as they place the dishes. Here, madam, and here. The family in the picture don't need servants, of course. They exist just by themselves, floating against the wall. "Eat, eat," says Moore. "All except Alice, who will burst out of her corset." At her name, she turns her head. "That expression of painful surprise is not native to her," Moore says. "It is produced by scraping back her hair and driving in great ivory pins to the peril of her skull. She believes her forehead is too low. It is, of course. Alice, Alice," he says, "remind me why I married you."
"To keep house, father," Meg says in a low voice.
"Yes, yes," Moore says. A glance at Alice frees me from stain of concupiscence. He is conscious of an oddity, as if time has performed some loop or snared itself in a noose. He has seen them on the wall as Hans froze them, and here they enact themselves, wearing their various expression of aloofness or amusement, benignity and grace. A happy family. He prefers their host as Hans painted it. The Thomas More on the wall, you can see that he's thinking, but not what he's thinking, and that's the way it should be. The painter has grouped them so skillfully that there's no space between the figures for anyone new. The outsider can only soak himself into the scene as an unintended blot or stain. Certainly, he thinks, Gardiner is a blot or stain. The secretary waves his black sleeves. He argues vigorously with their host. What does St. Paul mean when he says Jesus was made a little lower than the angels? Do Hollanders ever make jokes? What is the proper coat of arms of the Duke of Norfolk's heir? Is that thunder in the distance? Or will this heat keep up? Just as in the painting, Alice has a little monkey on a gilt chain. In the painting, it plays about her skirts. In life, it sits in her lap and clings to her like a child. Sometimes she lowers her head and talks to it, so that no one else can hear. Moore takes no wine, though he serves it to his guests. There are several dishes, which all taste the same. Flesh of some sort, with a gritty sauce like Thames mud. And then junkets, and a cheese which he says one of his daughters has made. One of his daughters, wards, stepdaughters, one of the women of whom the house is full.
"Because one must keep them employed," he says. "They cannot always be at their books, and young women are prone to mischief and idleness."
"For sure," he mutters. "They'll be fighting in the streets next." His eyes are drawn unwillingly to the cheese. It is pitted and wobbling, like the face of a stable boy after a night out.
"Henry Patterson is excitable tonight," Moore says. "Perhaps he should be bled. I hope his diet has not been too rich."
"Oh," says Gardiner, "I have no anxieties on that score." Old John Moore, who must be 80 now, has come in for supper, and so they yield the conversation to him. He is fond of telling stories.
"Did you ever hear of Humphrey, Duke of Gloucester, and the beggar who claimed to be blind? Did you ever hear of the man who didn't know the Virgin Mary was a Jew?"
Of such a sharp old lawyer one hopes for more, even in his dotage. Then he begins on anecdotes of foolish women, of which he has a vast collection, and even when he falls asleep, their host has more. Lady Alice sits scowling. Gardiner, who has heard all these stories before, is grinding his teeth.
"Look there at my daughter-in-law, Anne," Moore says.
The girl lowers her eyes, her shoulders tense as she waits for what is coming.
"Anne craved, shall I tell them, my dear? She craved a pearl necklace. She did not cease to talk about it. You know how young girls are. So when I gave her a box that rattled, imagine her face. Imagine her face again when she opened it. What was inside? Dried peas."
The girl takes a deep breath. She raises her face. He sees the effort it costs her. "Father," she says, "don't forget to tell the story of the woman who didn't believe the world was round."
"No, that's a good one," Moore says.
When he looks at Alice, staring at her husband with painful concentration, he thinks she still doesn't believe it. After supper, they talk about Wicked King Richard. Many years ago, Thomas More began to write a book about him. He could not decide whether to compose in English or Latin, so he has done both, though he has never finished it or sent any part of it to the printer. Richard was born to be evil, More says. It was written on him from his birth. He shakes his head. Deeds of blood. King's games.
Dark days, says the fool.
Let them never come again.
Amen.
The fool points to the guests.
Let these not come again either.
There are people in London who say that John Howard, grandfather of the Norfolk that is now, was more than a little concerned in the disappearance of the children who went into the Tower and never came out again. The Londoners say, and he reckons the Londoners know, that it was on Howard's watch that the princes were last seen, though Thomas More thinks it was Constable Brackenbury who handed the keys to the killers. Brackenbury died at Bosworth. He can't come out of his grave and complain. The fact is, Thomas More is thick with the Norfolk that is now, and keen to deny that his ancestor helped disappear anyone, let alone two children of royal blood. In his mind's eye, he frames the present Duke. In one dripping, sinewy hand, he holds a small, golden-haired corpse, and in the other, the kind of little knife a man brings to table to cut his meat. He comes back to himself. Gardiner, jabbing the air, is pressing the Lord Chancellor on his evidence. Presently, the fool's grumbling and groaning become unbearable. Father, Margaret says, please send Henry out. More rises to scold him, take him by the arm. All eyes follow him. But Gardiner takes advantage of the lull. He leans in, speaks English in an undertone. About Master Risley, remind me, is he working for me or for you? For you, I would have thought. Now he is made a clerk of the signet. They assist Master Secretary, do they not? Why, is he always at your house? He's not a bound apprentice. He may come and go. I suppose he's tired of churchmen. He wants to know what he can learn from whatever it is you call yourself these days. A person, he says placidly. The Duke of Norfolk says I'm a person. Master Risley has his eye on his advantage. I hope we all have that. Or why did God give us eyes? He thinks of making his fortune. We all know that money sticks to your hands. Like the aphids to Moore's roses. No, he sighs. It passes through them, alas. You know, Stephen, how I love luxury. Show me a carpet, and I'll walk on it. The fool scolded and ejected. Moore rejoins them. Alice, I have told you about drinking wine. Your nose is glowing. Alice's face grows stiff, with dislike and a kind of fear. The younger women, who understand all that is said, bow their heads and examine their hands, fiddling with their rings and turning them to catch the light. Then something lands on the table with a thud, and Anne Cressacre, provoked into her native tongue, cries, "Henry, stop that!" There is a gallery above with oriel windows. The fool, leaning through one of them, is peppering them with broken crusts.
"Don't flinch, masters," he shouts. "I am pelting you with God!"
He scores a hit on the old man, who wakes with a start. Sir John looks about him. With his napkin, he wipes dribble from his chin.
"Now, Henry," More calls up, "you have wakened my father, and you are blaspheming and wasting bread."
"Dear Lord, he should be whipped," Alice snaps.
He looks around him. He feels something which he identifies as pity, a heavy stirring beneath the breastbone. He believes Alice has a good heart, continues to believe it even when, taking his leave, permitted to thank her in English, he raps out, "Thomas Cromwell, why don't you marry again?" "No one will have me, Lady Alice." "Nonsense. Your master may be down, but you're not poor, are you? Got your money abroad, that's what I'm told. Got a good house, haven't you? Got the king's ear, my husband says. and from what my sisters in the city say, got everything in good working order.
Alice, Moore says. Smiling, he takes her wrist, shakes her a little. Gardiner laughs, his deep bass chuckle, like laughter through a crack in the earth. When they go out to Master Secretary's barge, the scent of the gardens is heavy in the air.
Moore goes to bed at 9 o'clock, Stephen says.
With Alice.
People say not.
You have spies in the house?
Stephen doesn't answer. It is dusk. Lights bob in the river.
Dear God, I'm hungry,
Master Secretary complains. I wish I'd kept back one of the fool's crusts. I wish I had laid hands on the white rabbit. I'd eat it raw.
He says, you know, he daren't make himself plain.
Indeed, he dare not, Gardiner says.
Beneath the canopy, he sits hunched into himself, as if he were cold.
But we all know his opinions, which I think are fixed and impervious to argument. When he took office, he said he would not meddle with the divorce, and the king accepted that, but I wonder how long he will accept it.
I didn't mean make himself plain to the king. I meant to Alice.
Gardiner laughs.
True.
If she understood what he said about her, she'd send him down to the kitchens and have him plucked and roasted.
Suppose she died. He'd be sorry then.
He'd have another wife in the house before she was cold, someone even uglier.
He broods, foresees vaguely an opportunity for placing bets.
That young woman, he says, Anne Cressacre. She's an heiress, you know, an orphan.
There was some scandal, was there not?
After her father died, her neighbours stole her for their son to marry. The boy raped her. She was 13. This was in Yorkshire. That's how they go on there. My Lord Cardinal was furious when he heard of it. It was he who got her away. He put her under Moore's roof because he thought she'd be safe. So she is.
Not from humiliation.
Since Moore's son married her, he lives off her lands. She has 100 a year. You'd think she could have a string of pearls.
Do you think Moore is disappointed in his boy? He shows no talent for affairs. Still, I hear you have a boy like that. You'll be looking for an heiress for him soon.
He doesn't reply. It's true. John Moore, Gregory Cromwell. What have we done to our sons? Made them into idle young gentlemen. But who can blame us for wanting for them the ease we didn't have? One thing about Moore, he's never idle for an hour. He's passed his life reading, writing, talking towards what he believes is the good of the Christian Commonwealth. Stephen says,
of course, you may have other sons. Aren't you looking forward to the wife Alice will find you? She is warm in your praises.
He feels afraid. It is like Mark, the lute player. People imagining what they cannot know. He is sure he and Joanne have been secret. He says,
don't you ever think of marrying?
A chill spreads over the waters.
I am in holy orders.
Oh, come on, Stephen. You must have women, don't you?
The pause is so long, so silent, that he can hear the oars as they dip into the Thames, the little splash as they rise. He can hear the ripples in their wake. He can hear a dog barking from the southern shore. The secretary asks,
what kind of Putney inquiry is that?
The silence lasts till Westminster, but on the whole, not too bad a trip. As he mentions, disembarking, neither of them has thrown the other in the river.
I'm waiting till the water's colder, Gardiner says, until I can tie weights to you. You have a trick of resurfacing, don't you? By the way, why am I bringing you to Westminster?
I'm going to see Lady Anne.
Gardiner is affronted.
You didn't say so.
Should I report all my plans to you?
He knows that is what Gardiner would prefer. The word is that the king is losing patience with his council. He shouts at them,
the cardinal was a better man than any of you for managing matters.
He thinks if my Lord Cardinal comes back, which by a caprice of the king's he may, any time now, Then you're all dead. Norfolk, Gardiner, Moore. Wolsey is a merciful man, but surely only up to a point. Mary Shelton is in attendance. She looks up, simpers. Anne is sumptuous in her nightgown of dark silk. Her hair is down, her delicate feet bare inside kidskin slippers. She's slumped in her chair, as if the day has beaten the spirit out of her. But still, as she looks up, her eyes are sparkling, hostile.
Where have you been?
Utopia.
Oh, she is interested. What passed?
Dame Alice has a little monkey that sits on her knee at table.
I hate them.
I know you do. He walks about. Anne lets him treat her family normally, except when she has a sudden, savage seizure of I who will be queen, and slaps him down. She examines the toe of her slipper.
They say that Thomas More is in love with his own daughter.
I think they may be right. Anne's sniggering laugh.
Is she a pretty girl?
No. Learned, though.
Did they talk about me?
They never mention you in that house. He thinks, I should like to hear Alice's verdict.
Then what was the talk?
The vices and follies of women.
I suppose you joined it. It's true, anyway. Most women are foolish and vicious. I have seen it. I have lived among the women too long.
He says, Norfolk and my lord your father are very busy seeing ambassadors. France, Venice, the Emperor's man, just in these last 2 days. He thinks they are working to entrap my cardinal. I know it.
I did not think you could afford such good information, though they say you have spent £1,000 on the cardinal.
I expect to get it back, from here and there.
I suppose people are grateful to you. If they have received grants out of the cardinal's lands...
He thinks your brother George, Lord Rochford, your father Thomas, Earl of Wiltshire, haven't they got rich from the cardinal's fall? Look at what George is wearing these days. Look at the money he spends on horses and girls. But I don't see much sign of gratitude from the Boleyns. He says, I just take my conveyancer's fee. She laughs.
You look well on it.
Do you know, there are ways and ways. Sometimes people just tell me things.
It is an invitation. Anne drops her head. She is on the verge of becoming one of those people. But perhaps not tonight.
My father says, one can never be sure of that person. One can never tell who he's working for. I should have thought, but then I am only a woman, that it's perfectly obvious that you're working for yourself.
That makes us alike, he thinks, but does not quite say.
Anne yawns, a little cat-like yawn.
You're tired, he says. I shall go. By the way, why did you send for me?
We like to know where you are.
So why does your lord father not send for me? Or your brother?
She looks up. It may be late, but not too late for Anne's knowing smile.
They do not think you would come.
August. The cardinal writes to the king, a letter full of complaint, saying that he's been hounded by his creditors, wrapped in misery and dread. But the stories that come back are different. He's holding dinners and inviting all the local gentry. He's dispensing charity on his old princely scale, settling lawsuits and sweet-talking estranged husbands and wives into sharing a roof again. Call Me Risley was up in Southwell in June with William Brereton of the King's Privy Chamber, getting the Cardinal's signature on a petition Henry is circulating, which he means to send to the Pope. It's Norfolk's idea to get the peers and bishops to sign up to this letter, asking Clement to let the King have his freedom. It contains certain murky, unspecific threats. But Clement's used to being threatened. No one's better at spinning a question out, setting one party against the other, playing ends against the middle. The Cardinal looks well, according to Risley, and his building work, it seems, has gone beyond repairs and a few renovations. He's been scouring the country for glaziers, joiners, and for plumbers. It is ominous when my lord decides to improve the sanitation. He never had a parish church, but he built the tower higher. Never lodged anywhere where he did not draw up drainage plans. Soon there will be earthworks, culverts, and pipes laid. Next, he will be installing fountains. Wherever he goes, he is cheered by the people.
The people, Norfolk says. They'd cheer a Barbary ape. Who cares what they'd cheer? Hang 'em all!
But then who will you tax, he says. And Norfolk looks at him fearfully, unsure if he's made a joke. Rumours of the Cardinal's popularity don't make him glad. They make him afraid. The King has given Wolsey a pardon. But if he was offended once, he can be offended again. If they could think up 44 charges then, if fantasy is unconstrained by truth, they can think up 44 more. He sees Norfolk and Gardiner with their heads together. They look up at him. They glare and don't speak. Risley stays with him, in his shadow and footsteps, writes his most confidential letters, those to the Cardinal and the King. He never says, I am too tired. He never says, it is late. He remembers all that he is required to remember. Even Rafe is not more perfect. It is time to bring the girls into the family business. Joanne complains of her daughter's poor sewing, and it seems that, transferring the needle surreptitiously into her wrong hand, the child has devised an awkward little backstitch which will be hard pushed to imitate. She gets the job of sewing up his dispatches for the North. September 1530. The Cardinal leaves Southwell, travelling by easy stages to York. The next part of his progress becomes a triumphal procession. People from all over the countryside flock to him, ambushing him at wayside crosses so that he can lay his magical hands on their children. They call it confirmation, but it seems to be some older sacrament. They pour in by the thousand to gawp at him, and he prays for them all. The council has the Cardinal under observation, Gardiner says, swishing past him. They have had the ports closed. Norfolk says,
tell him if I ever see him again, I will chew him up, bones, flesh and gristle.
He writes it down just so and sends it up country. Bones, flesh and gristle. He can hear the crunch and snap of the Duke's teeth. On the 2nd of October, the Cardinal reaches his palace at Caywood, 10 miles from York. His enthronement is planned for the 7th of November. News comes that he has called the convocation of the Northern Church. It is to meet at York the day after his enthronement. It is a signal of his independence. Some may think it is a signal of revolt. He has not informed the King. He has not informed old Warham, Archbishop of Canterbury. He can hear the Cardinal's voice, soft and amused, saying, now, Thomas, why do they need to know? Norfolk calls him in. His face is crimson, and he froths a little at the mouth as he starts to shout. He has been seeing his armour for a fitting, and is still wearing sundry parts. His cuirass, his garderance, so that he looks like an iron pot wobbling to the boil.
Does he think he can dig in up there and carve himself a kingdom? Cardinal's hat not enough for him? Only a crown will do for Thomas Bloody Wolsey, the bleeding butcher's boy, and I tell you!
He drops his gaze in case the Duke should stop to read his thoughts. He thinks, my lord would have made such an excellent king, so benign, so sure and suave in his dealings, so equitable, so swift, and so discerning. His rule would have been the best rule, his servants the best servants, and how he would have enjoyed his state. His glance follows the Duke as he bobs and froths, but to his surprise, when the Duke turns, he smites his own mettled thigh, and a tear at the pain, or something else, bubbles into his eye.
Ah, you think me a hard man, Cromwell? I am not such a hard man that I don't see how you are left. Do you know what I say? I say I don't know one man in England who would have done what you have done for a man disgraced and fallen. The king says so. Even him, Chapuis, the emperor's man, he says, you cannot fault what's he called. I say, it's a pity you ever saw Wolsey. It's a pity you don't work for me.
Well, he says, we all want the same thing. For your niece to be queen. Can we not work together?
Norfolk grunts. There is something amiss in his view with that word together, but he cannot articulate what it is.
Do not forget your place.
He bows. I am mindful of your lordship's continuing favour.
Look here, Cromwell. I wish you would come down and see me at home at Kenning Hall and talk to my lady wife. She's a woman of monstrous demands. She thinks I shouldn't keep a woman in the house for my pleasant usage, you know. I say, where else should she be? Do you want me to disturb myself on a winter's night and venture out on the icy roads? I don't seem to be able to express myself correctly to her. Do you think you could come down and put my case?
He says hastily.
Not now, of course, no. More urgent. See my niece.
How is she?
In my view, Norfolk says, Anne's out for bloody murder. She wants the cardinal's guts in a dish to feed to her spaniels, and his limbs nailed all over the city gates of York.
It is a dark morning, and your eyes naturally turn towards Anne. But something shadowy is bobbing about on the fringes of the circle of light. Anne says, Dr. Cranmer is just back from Rome. He brings us no good news, of course. They know each other. Cranmer has worked from time to time for the Cardinal, as indeed, who has not? Now he is active in the King's case. They embrace cautiously. Cambridge scholar, person from Putney. He says, Master, why would you not come to our college? To Cardinal College, I mean. His Grace was very sorry you would not. We would have made you comfortable.
I think he wanted more permanence, Anne says, sneering.
But with respect, Lady Anne, the King has almost said to me that he will take over the Oxford Foundation himself. He smiles. Perhaps it can be called after you. This morning, Anne wears a crucifix on a gold chain. Sometimes her fingers pull at it impatiently, and then she tucks her hands back in her sleeves. It is so much a habit with her that people say she has something to hide, a deformity. But he thinks she is a woman who doesn't like to show her hand.
My uncle Norfolk says Wolsey goes about with 800 armed men at his back. They say he has letters from Catherine. Is that true? They say Rome will issue a decree telling the king to separate from me.
That would be a clear mistake on Rome's part, Cranmer says.
Yes, it would, because he won't be told. Is he some parish clerk, the King of England, or some child? This would not happen in France. Their king keeps his churchmen under his hand. Master Tyndale says, one king, one law, is God's ordinance in every realm. I have read his book, The Obedience of a Christian Man. I myself have shown it to the king and marked the passages that touch on his authority. The subject must obey his king as he would his God. Do I have a sense of it? The Pope will learn his place.
Cranmer looks at her with a half smile. She's like a child who you're teaching to read, who dazzles you by sudden aptitude.
Wait, she says. I have something to show you.
She darts a look.
Lady Carey...
Oh, please, Mary says. Do not give it currency.
Anne snaps her fingers. Mary Boleyn moves forward into the light, a flash of blonde hair.
Give it,
Anne says. It is a paper, which she unfolds.
I found this in my bed, would you believe? As it happened, it was a night when that sickly milk-faced creeper had turned down the sheet, and of course I could not get any sense out of her. She cries if you look at her sideways, so I cannot know who put it there.
She unfolds a drawing. There are three figures. The central figure is the king. He is large and handsome, and to make sure you don't miss him, he's wearing a crown. On either side of him is a woman. The one on the left has no head. "That's the queen," she says. "Catherine." "And that's me," she laughs. "Anne Santet." Dr. Cranmer holds out his hand for the paper.
"Give it to me. I'll destroy it."
She crumples it in her fist. "I can destroy it myself. There is a prophecy that a queen of England will be burned. But a prophecy does not frighten me. And even if it is true, I will run the risk." Mary stands like a statue, in the position where Anne left her. Her hands are joined, as if the paper was still between them. "Oh, Christ," he thinks, "to see her out of here, to take her to somewhere she could forget she's a Boleyn. She asked me once. I failed her. If she asked me again, I would fail her again." Anne turns against the light. Her cheeks are hollow. How thin she is now. Her eyes are alight.
"Ainsi sera," she says. "Never mind who grudges it. It will happen. I mean to have him."
On their way out, he and Dr. Cranmer do not speak till they see the little pale girl coming towards them, the sickly milk-faced creeper, carrying folded linen. "I think this is the one who cries," he says, "so do not look at her sideways."
"Master Cromwell," she says, "this may be a long winter. Send us some more of your orange tarts."
"I haven't seen you for so long. What have you been doing? Where have you been?"
"Sewing, mostly."
She considers each question separately.
"Where I'm sent."
"And spying, I think."
She nods. "I'm not very good at it."
"I don't know. You're very small and unnoticeable." He means it as a compliment. She blinks in acknowledgement.
"I don't speak French, so don't you, if you please. It gives me nothing to report."
"Who are you spying for?"
"My brothers."
"Do you know Dr. Cranmer?"
"No," she says.
She thinks it's a real question. "Now," he instructs her, "you must say who you are."
"Oh, I see. I'm John Seymour's daughter from Wolf Hall."
He is surprised. "I thought his daughters were with Queen Catherine."
"Yes, sometimes. Not now. I told you, I go where I'm sent."
"But not where you are appreciated."
"I am, in the one way. You see, Lady Anne will not refuse any of the Queen's ladies who want to spend time with her."
She raises her eyes, a pale, momentary brightness.
"Very few do."
Every rising family needs information. With a king himself a bachelor, any little girl can hold the key to the future. And not all his money is on Anne. "Well, good luck," he says. "I'll try to keep it in English."
"I would be obliged,"
she bows.
"Dr. Cranmer?"
He turns to watch as she patters off in the direction of Anne Boleyn. A small suspicion as his mind. The paper in the bed. "No, no," he thinks. "That is not possible." Dr. Cranmer smiling.
"You have a wide acquaintance among the court ladies?"
"Not very wide. I still don't know which daughter that was. At least. And I suppose Seymour's sons are ambitious."
"Hardly know them."
The Cardinal brought Edward up. He's sharp. And Tom Seymour is not such a fool as he pretends."
"The father?"
"Stays in Wiltshire. We never see him."
"One could envy him,"
Dr. Cranmer murmurs. "Country life, rural felicity, a temptation he has never known. How long?"
"The father?"
"King called you up." Cranmer smiles.
26 years.
They are both dressed for riding. You're going back to Cambridge today?"
"Not to stay. The family..."
The Boleyns, he means.
want to have me at hand. And you, Master Cromwell?
A private client. I can't make a living from Lady Anne's black looks. Boys wait with their horses. From various folds of his garments, Dr. Cranmer produces objects wrapped in cloth. One of them is a carrot, cut carefully lengthways, and another a wizened apple, quartered. As if he were a child, fair-minded with the treat, he gives him two slices of carrot and half the apple, to feed to his own horse. And as he does so, he says,
"You owe much to Anne Boleyn, more than perhaps you think. She has formed a good opinion of you. I'm not sure she cares to be your sister-in-law, mind."
The beasts bend their necks, nibbling, their ears flicking appreciation. Of peace, like a benediction. He says, "There are no secrets, are there?"
"No, no, absolutely none."
The priest shakes his head.
"You asked why I would not come to your college?"
"I was making conversation."
"Still, as we heard it in Cambridge, you performed such labours for the foundation. The students and fellows all commend you. No detail escapes Master Cromwell. Though, to be sure, this comfort on which you pride yourselves..."
His tone, smooth and unemphatic, doesn't change.
"In the fish cellar, where the students died?"
"My Lord Cardinal did not take that lightly." Cranmer says lightly.
"Nor did I."
"My Lord was never a man to ride down another for his opinions. You would have been safe."
"I assure you, he would have found no heresy in me. Even the Sorbonne could not fault me. I've nothing to be afraid of."
A wan smile.
"But perhaps... oh, well, perhaps I'm just a Cambridge man at heart."
This ends Disc 8.